showed up at my door, all he said was, "You need to call your dad." My dad started crying, and he told me that there had been a fire at my mom's house. The only people living in the house was my mom, Vicky, her boyfriend, John, and my little sister, Becky.
We're still waiting for positive identification on three bodies found at a burned-out home in Pinyon Pines.
We knew right away that everyone was dead. Maybe my mom fell asleep with a cigarette or a gas leak. But what happened was much, much worse. I learned that Becky was found in a wheelbarrow. Apparently she had been placed in this and set on fire. The baby sister was caught.
Why bring her body towards the front of the house? We think it was to pose her, and they wanted to leave some kind of symbol, make it as personal as possible.
Becky was placed in a wheelbarrow and lit on fire. When the crime scene was released, we went up there, myself and other family members, and that wheelbarrow was still there. There was still flesh in the wheelbarrow that had never been removed. And that, I've never gotten over that. That I truly believe in my heart that the people that are involved in this homicide will actually hurt somebody again. Those people are in the community. They're living next to people that have no idea who they are or what they've done. And it's scary. I lost my daughter, and I know what it feels like. And I don't want anybody else to go through the same thing.
Hi, this is True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
Hi there, this is Dick.
Today's episode is Cruel Intentions, The Murders in Pinyon Pines. So all that's left now of the Friedley family home in Pinyon Pines, California, is the foundation. It was burned to the ground on September 7th, 2006, leaving behind horror and immeasurable pain, along with the idyllic childhood memories of those who grew up there. Inside the home, investigators found the bodies of 53-year-old Vicky Friedley and her long-term boyfriend, 55-year-old John Hayward. They had both been shot, although that would not be determined until much later. You see, they'd been burnt beyond recognition. Outside, in a burning wheelbarrow, were the charred remains of Becky Friedley, an 18-year-old, high-spirited and intelligent young woman, with most of her life still ahead of her, until it was ended senselessly and cruelly. This terrible crime went unsolved for years, and the two suspects are currently awaiting trial. This, despite the fact that Becky's family and friends feel that they knew who committed these crimes back in 2006. Why has justice been so delayed? And what possible motive could have evoked such violence? This is what we'll be addressing on today's episode of True Crime Brewery. But first, let's read a couple of our five-star reviews, pour our beer, and head on down to the quiet end. So, our five-star reviews that I'm going to read today. First of all, I've got, "I am a convert." So I like the sounds of that. This is by Debbie K01. "I started listening months ago. At first, I was underwhelmed, but I kept listening. Now, whenever a new episode pops up, a big smile spreads across my face. I listen immediately. It's like picking up a new book that you are dying to read. I love the fact that unlike so many other podcasts, they don't talk over each other. Each lets the other actually finish a sentence before they start speaking. They do an excellent job of discussing crimes, some I'm familiar with, others not so much. They have a nice dynamic together. I wish they'd have a meet and greet someday so I could put some faces to those voices."
Well, that's very nice, isn't it?
I thought it was a very nice review. So I'd just like to say welcome to the brewery, Debbie.
Welcome, Debbie. I think I would agree that we were underwhelming to begin with, but we were feeling our way and trying to get our style going. I think we're starting to hit a stride here, and I think we're doing better.
Okay, the other one I was going to read is from Janisha Vale, and I'm not going to read the whole thing because Janisha wrote pretty much an essay, and I don't say that in a negative way. It's a beautiful essay, but of course I'm not going to read it all. But the beginning starts out, I just want to say I listen to a lot of podcasts on Google Play, mostly true crime, and I love the fact that, number one, you two are a couple that tend to make two different points of view and sometimes even respectfully disagree with each other. I have used your interactions and the way you behave with each other in my own relationship. My partner is an introvert and I am very extroverted, which causes some turmoil at times, but now I tend to remember how civil you two are when you disagree and have actually calmed down in my relationship. So it goes on to say a lot of complimentary things, but I think that was great. That really made my day when I read this.
Well, that's really cool.
Yeah, it's good to think you could make a difference like that in someone's life. It's certainly not what we expect from doing a podcast on true crime.
That's for sure.
Yeah. But I'd just like to say welcome to the brewery, Tanisha, and thank you so much.
Thanks, Tanisha. That was a great review. Good going.
So what have we got for a beer today?
Well, we have a California beer, right?
Right. This happened in Pinyon Pines, California.
Yes. So I'm taking a beer from Coachella Valley Brewing Company, which is pretty nearby, all this stuff. The beer is Phoenix. It's a Vienna lager. So Vienna lagers tend to have fairly subtle hops. They're not real hop bombs. They tend to be crisp and some residual sweetness. The alcohol by volume ranges from 3.5% to 6.5%. So these are what would be considered session beers that you can sit down and drink a few of them without getting blasted. So the Phoenix beer is brewed with three malts and locally grown dates. And I learned something when I was looking at this beer. This area, the Coachella Valley, is where the date farmers live. So all these palm trees are date trees, and they harvest dates. So this particular beer has dates in it. I know you're all excited about that.
So dates are good. I have nothing against dates. I like dates.
This particular beer is a dark reddish-brown color without much of a head. There's a faint fruit aroma and a faint taste of dates and figs. It's light and a fairly sweet mouthfeel. So I was a little bit on the border of this one. It's certainly not one of my favorite beers, but nor is it one of my least favorite beers. It's an okay beer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So let's take it down and drink some more.
Okay. What's our glassware today?
Today we're just using some pint glasses.
Nice. Okay. Let's open her up.
All right, let's pop that top. Looks like the quiet end isn't actually that quiet today. There's a bunch of football games on.
Oh.
So I think we should think about going someplace other than a sports bar to be doing this stuff.
Well, how about that little booth in the corner?
Yeah, I mean, that's away from the action, so maybe it won't be too bad. Let's try it.
Okay, so today we'll go to the booth.
Okay.
All right, so let's talk about Cruel Intentions. You ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Now, Ron Friedley, he built a house in Pinyon Pines himself up in the mountains above the desert heat of the Coachella Valley. Ron and his wife Vicky doted on their three daughters, Drew, Tanya, and Becky. The house in the country was Ron's way of keeping his daughters away from the troubles of city life. Now, Becky was the youngest daughter, the baby of the family. She was smart, and she did well in school, even helping her older sisters with their homework. So there was a lot of love in this family, even though the marriage of Ron and Vicky didn't last. The two grew apart and divorced after 13 years together. But as time went by, Drew and Tanya grew up, and they moved away. But Becky still lived with her mom and her mom's new love, John Howard.
And her father lived nearby.
Yes.
Right.
He was still involved in her life,
yeah,
yes.
He was very involved with his kids.
Yes.
So even though they were divorced, he wasn't a disappearing dad.
No, not at all. No. So Becky's sisters say that Becky and John got along well. They both loved the outdoors, and they enjoyed life in Pinyon Pines. John's daughter, Katie Howard, urged them to move to the city, but John would say to her, "It's free up here. It's the safest place for us to be."
Whoa. Kind of prophetic, huh?
Kind of sad when you look back now,
yeah.
But then came the day of September 17th, 2006, and Vicky, John, and Becky were murdered at Pinyon Pines. At first, no one would imagine anyone wanting to hurt any of these three people. Rumors began about the murderer being someone with a grudge against Ron Friedley, because Ron had recently retired from the Riverside County Sheriff's Department. So Ron didn't have any serious enemies, though, from his work in law enforcement, he said. So eventually the police did rule out that idea as a motive for these murders.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they questioned the ex-husband and did a polygraph test with him, and he did fine.
Yes, he took the polygraph, and he was interviewed by investigators. And this was really tough for Ron because he was grieving for his daughter, of course. And he also felt a lot of guilt for not being there to protect her because of the divorce.
Right, but, I mean, they were divorced. And so other than seeing her on occasion, I mean, he's not going to live there with her.
Sure, but parents always feel guilty.
Well, yeah.
You always want to protect your child no matter what.
Absolutely.
But, of course, he passed this polygraph without question. And he'd been 11 hours away at the time that it happened, up in his property in Northern California. So he felt guilty that he wasn't nearby, but also that ruled him out as a suspect because he wasn't anywhere nearby where he could have done anything.
Nowhere nearby. And as you said, yeah, you're going to feel guilt that you weren't there for your child.
Absolutely.
But, who's going to predict what happens?
Nobody, and none of us blame him, but I can certainly understand as a parent how he felt.
Oh, sure.
Very guilty and bad about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Jeannie McDaniel, a friend of Becky's, was absolutely certain who committed these murders right away as soon as she heard about them. And the last thing that had occurred to Ron was that Becky was the target of the murders. But as this investigation evolved and Becky's friends met with Becky's family, it did become clear that Becky was the target. And the suspect in this case was Becky's ex-boyfriend.
Right. But just, I mean, when you look at the scene, mother and boyfriend are in the house with bullets in their bodies.
Yes.
And Becky's kind of posed out front in a wheelbarrow, burning. I can't comprehend how cruel that is.
It's horrendous.
And hopefully she was unconscious when they set her on fire, but...
And that's all we can hope for, really, because that's horrible.
I mean, the killers wanted her to be seen first. She was the centerpiece.
It sure seems that way.
Of the crime.
Absolutely. Now, back when Becky was a child, her mom was making tacos, and Becky had pulled a pan of hot grease off the stove, splashing some, and she ended up with serious burns on her chest. So her friend Jeannie McDonald knew that Becky had third-degree burns on her chest. And she also knew that Becky's ex-boyfriend, Robert Pape, would know about these burns and about Becky's long-running, intense fear of fire because of this childhood incident.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. So the thinking is, because we're going to find out that her ex-boyfriend is one of the suspects.
Yes, he's the main suspect.
And that's just a way of him demonstrating his superiority over her.
Superiority? Well,
yeah, he knew she was afraid of...
It's absolutely cruel, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He knew she was terribly afraid of fire.
Right.
And burns.
So if he did this, he did the worst thing that could have been imaginable for her.
Yeah.
Which makes it exceptionally cruel.
Oh, no question.
Yeah. So Jeannie's mind went to having suspicions of Robert Pape, Becky's ex-boyfriend, right away. And in her mind, he was the only one who could have committed this crime. It's the only thing that made sense to her, the whole... wheelbarrow thing, the fire. It just made sense that it was him.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. So going back a little, Robert Pape was Becky's first love. They dated in high school. For over a year, the two were a couple, and Becky loved Robert. But according to her friends, Robert became very possessive of Becky, and that's when the relationship eventually soured. Now, Jeannie has said that when she and Becky took a girls' trip together, just 10 months before Becky was murdered, Robert had called Becky 20 to 30 times in one evening.
Wow.
He was clearly harassing her, trying to talk to her and keep her attention while the two girls were trying to be out and have some fun with other friends.
Yeah. I mean, he's a stalker.
Yeah, yeah. So there was certainly an issue there with him being obsessive and possessive with her.
Yeah.
So, according to Becky's friends, Becky broke up with Robert in January of 2006. So, same year of the crime. The crime happened in September of that year.
Right.
And they each saw other people. But Robert's obsessive behavior did not wane. It worsened.
Yeah, they got into some big discussion before the day before she was found murdered, right?
According to her friends, yes. Now, 3 weeks before she died, Becky came to Jeannie's house and told her that he had even threatened to kill her. And Jeannie didn't really take that very seriously because Becky didn't seem really concerned or to take it seriously herself. So even though he said these things, the girls didn't really seem to understand that these were probably real threats.
Oh, God.
What?
We hear this all the time.
Yeah.
And you get these threats and you don't take them seriously.
Well, because a lot of times in life people say these things and they don't do them.
Yeah.
Right?
I would be really worried.
Well, sure, but these are teenage girls.
Okay.
Right?
Another species.
Well, I think that, you know, young people say things like this sometimes and don't mean it. So, not knowing him, I can't say, but obviously they should have taken it more seriously. Obviously, he did mean it. I mean, if he's guilty, which he seems to be from what I've investigated and learned so far.
Right. If he's the one, although the evidence points to him.
A lot of it does. Most of it does. And we'll get to that.
We will.
Yeah. But so after the murders, Jeannie McDaniel went straight to the Riverside County Sheriff's Department with her suspicions. And then she found out that Robert was already a suspect. So the investigation was leading police to Robert Pape anyway. And what she said obviously just added fuel to the fire. No pun intended there. Now, according to another close friend of Becky, on the night of the murders, Becky had told him that she was going hiking on her property with Robert Pape, and his friend Christian Smith. Now, Becky's sister believes that Becky was just trying to smooth things over with Robert. Despite Robert's harassment and his threats, Becky believed she could help him and they could end up remaining friends after all this. So this led police to Robert Pape and his friend Christian Smith after they heard about that. And actually, this lead placed these two guys, Robert and Christian, at the scene of the crime on the night of the murders. So Becky's family believed that these two men would soon be arrested based on all this.
Well, you would assume.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like the guy has a motive because they're no longer a couple.
Right.
They had a heated argument, I think, the day before.
I think that was. We haven't come to that, but I think there was something a day or two before, yeah.
Yeah. And they were in the area.
Yes, then they found out that they were in the area.
And we know that, not just from cell phone pings, but from some DNA evidence, too.
Don't get ahead of us now. We're getting to that.
I won't.
So the Riverside County Sheriff's Department never publicly named the two as suspects, and nothing actually happened with this case for several years.
No, nothing happened.
Nope. So it was very frustrating for the family, of course.
The prosecutor who oversaw the case before it went cold, his name is Bill Mitchell.
Yeah.
He said the evidence was too weak to take to trial. Though I guess they felt like they didn't have enough to link Pape to the crime. The investigation seemed to go nowhere. About 6 years after the occurrence, the governor of California, who was Arnold Schwarzenegger back then.
The governor.
Right. Offered a $50,000 reward for information leading to a conviction in the case.
Mm-hmm.
Behind the scenes, the police were looking at the movements of Pape and his friend Kristen Smith the night of the murders. Search of their homes in 2007 found guns matching the type used to kill John Howard and Vicki Friedley. They also had DNA evidence matching Kristen Smith to the scene. There was a business card or something found in there.
Mm-hmm.
So even though they had that evidence for several years, the prosecutors didn't seek an indictment until 2014. You wonder why.
Now, Bill Mitchell, he was the assistant DA for the area in 2007 and 2008. Now, he said investigators worked tirelessly before hitting a wall in 2008. When a Riverside County Superior Court judge had denied a request for a search warrant. So Robert Pape was living in Cathedral City, California in 2014 and working as a local air conditioning repairman. He had married his wife Sarah and she was supporting him. And Christian Smith had served in the U.S. Army for 5 years. He had 4 tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, and at the time of his 2014 arrest, he was actually a highly decorated member of the 2nd Ranger Battalion, and he actually had received two Purple Hearts. So that made him kind of an unusual suspect.
Well, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got a soldier who's decorated.
Right.
Who's true to his country.
Yes.
It's hard to believe he could be involved in a murder.
Well, and at this point, the two were leading kind of upstanding lives, I guess, would be one way to put it.
Well, for sure. So the alleged motive for the murders was revealed to the public at the time of their 2014 arrests.
That's right, yeah.
According to a friend of Becky's who spoke with her on the phone for 3 hours before she was killed, Becky told him she was waiting on Kristen Smith and Robert Pate because they were going on a hike behind Becky's house. Two friends also said that Becky had told them Robert had threatened to kill her.
Right.
So the hike was to defuse the situation and try to get him and her to a point where they weren't fighting.
Well, we don't really know. We don't know. Becky's family and friends think that Becky was probably trying to smooth things over and just kind of discuss,
yeah,
you know, the end of their relationship and how to move forward.
Right. I mean, this was after the dispute at Becky's place of work.
Well, that's contested whether they had that dispute or not, but
well,
according to some people, that did happen.
There were eyewitnesses that said it was quite a loud verbal altercation. And so she suggested, you know, come out, let's take a walk, and we can figure this out.
Well, no, I don't think she suggested it. That's the thing. I think Robert Pape suggested it. And people who believe that he killed her think that that was a setup to kill her.
Oh.
So I don't think she suggested it, but I think that she went along with it, thinking that they were going to work things out. And, you know.
Okay. Well, that puts a whole different thing on it for me.
Yes.
The other thing I couldn't understand is why Kristen Smith was there.
Well, I think he was his accomplice.
Yeah, but he doesn't have anything to do with the relationship between the two of them.
No, but these are like close pals.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know why.
I don't know exactly why he got involved. The only motive for him really was that he was helping out his friend.
Yeah, I guess I can see that. But
so if
I'm Becky, I'm thinking, why is this guy here? You know, it's between you and I, Robert. Let's settle this and be moving on.
But on the other hand, maybe she would feel better having someone else there. Because you're going to think that if you have two people with you, that they're not going to hurt you. If you're with your ex-boyfriend, it might be kind of nerve-wracking if he's been violent before.
Well, we don't know he's violent. We've been told, allegedly, that he threatened to kill her.
Yes.
So, yeah, I guess I can see that. Maybe there's better safety.
Perhaps.
With a third party.
I mean, it's all just speculation, really.
It is.
But I do believe that it was suggested by the two young men, not by her.
That they go for a hike and
yes,
settle things.
Right, right.
So Robert Pape told investigators that he and Becky had dated for 15 months, but it ended in January of 2006 because she cheated on him.
That's what he said.
That's his story.
Yes.
He also told investigators that he and Kristen decided to not go on the hike and were alone together the entire night of the murders. So they have each other's alibi.
Yeah, which isn't super convincing. Now that you think about it.
So, but despite their claims that they were never at the Friedley's house that night, their cell phone activity placed them near the house before and after the crimes. And they have guns that resemble the caliber of the guns that killed the people. And they have Kristen's DNA on a business card that's sitting there.
Right, right. And another suspicious thing is that these two guys had their phones off for 4 hours that evening, starting at 7 p.m. And police affidavits describe that as an unprecedented anomaly in their cellular activity records. So, thinking of most people, myself included, really, you don't turn your phone off. When does that ever happen, really? Very rarely.
It never happens. I mean, it happens when you're trying to get some of the bugs out or something.
Right,
you know,
right.
Your phone's always on.
Yeah. So it's very, very strange if you think about these two young men having their phones off that evening that she died.
At the same hours.
And then when the phone was on, they were going to her house and coming from her house.
Right.
It turns out.
Yeah, they didn't think that through enough, did they?
No, no. So another suspicious thing noted by investigators was this instant messaging conversation that Robert had with a girl a few months before the murders. So this girl was complaining to Robert in the messages about a relationship and a guy that was still bothering her. And Robert told her that if she knew where this guy lived, he could professionally burn his house down. And then she made some kind of comment like, oh yeah, you're a pyro, aren't you? And he said, yeah, I've already gone through 5 books of matches or something. I don't remember the exact quote. But it was very suggestive. It really didn't put things in his favor as far as I'm concerned. It made it look like he was a guy who would like to start a fire.
No, it sure wouldn't. I mean, it sounds like he's an arsonist or potential arsonist.
And there were several people in their crowd, you know, and the young people that hung out with them through high school that said that both of these guys really had a fascination with fire. There was one incident where Robert and Christian started a mattress on fire, and Becky really got mad and didn't talk to Christian for a few days because of this.
Huh.
So the fact that they may have been really interested in doing things with fire adds to the suspicions here for sure.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's some more circumstantial stuff.
Yeah. So the wheelbarrow that Becky was found in, it left a trail actually leading away from the home. There were 2 sets of footprints following the wheelbarrow. And near the wheelbarrow's starting point, investigators found the business card that had Christian Smith's DNA on it. So that was a pretty good piece of evidence there.
You know, you hear all this stuff, and I know it's all circumstantial, but you would think it has a pretty good case.
You would think so. I guess what Christian Smith's lawyer said about the card was that he could have given that card to her. I mean, just because it was a card with his DNA doesn't really say that he was there, right? Because it could have been handed off.
Well, I can see that, certainly, but what relationship did they have? They didn't. I mean, they had a third-party relationship through Robert.
Right, right.
So, I mean, it wasn't like he was out at her house or anything necessarily.
No, but what if he gave the card to Robert and Robert left there?
But Robert's DNA wasn't on it, just his.
Oh, good point. That's true. But does everyone who handled the card necessarily leave their DNA on it?
Well,
probably.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, I guess the odds that it was his were something like one. The odds that it wasn't him, am I saying this right, were 1 in 324,000?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, based on the way they could do DNA testing several years ago.
Right. So now, at this time, they have more affirmative.
Yeah.
Affirmative
it
DNA
makes it a much
results.
More likely thing.
Right, right.
Although I would think 1 in 300,000 is pretty small odds anyway.
Sure. It is. Yeah. But it's not 100%.
No?
No.
Well, it never is. I mean, you can say it's 1 in 500 million. Or 1 in...
But when you get up in the millions, to me, that seems much more...
Well, I know, but it's
impossible
not
to be.
It's not indicative.
No.
I mean, it's suggestive.
It's very suggestive.
And the bigger the numbers, the more suggestive it is, but...
Absolutely.
It never approaches 100% certainty.
Well, it approaches it. It just might not reach it.
Right.
So the thing to think about is, why was this case dismissed? Because they were arrested in 2014. And then 6 months later, the case was dismissed. And they were let go. So Rod Paccio, the former Riverside County DA, who specialized in high-profile homicides, said that he could not remember any other Riverside County death penalty case that had been dismissed by prosecutors.
Well,
it's unprecedented.
We're looking at this case, and we see that the boys had been arrested and then dismissed in 6 months. The charges were dismissed 6 months later. And I'm thinking, well, how do you do that? If you don't have the evidence, you don't indict them.
Sure, but was there something suspicious about when they were dropped? It was dropped on a Friday.
Yeah, no, I...
So tell me about that. You read that article.
There's some big suspicions.
Sure.
The private investigator who had been hired by the family to look at things.
Well, he wasn't really hired. He was a friend of Ron Friedley's, and he did it pro bono.
Well, okay, but he was still hired.
Louis Bolanos, yes.
And his thinking is that the district attorney was in the midst of a highly contested re-election.
And that's why he arrested
them. And he arrested them because it would look good for him. But then defense was going to call him to testify before the grand jury.
Yes, on that Monday.
On that Monday.
The Monday after that Friday that the case was dropped.
Because they were going to talk to him about being pressured to arrest and to drop the case. Or he decided to drop the case.
Well, we don't really know what they were going to talk to him about. You're guessing that.
I'm guessing that. But we do know that the district attorney had been videotaped or filmed tearing up his opponent's signs.
Okay, well, go back a little and explain that whole thing to me.
What whole thing?
The whole thing about the signs.
So, like I said, he was in a tightly contested race for district attorney.
Paul Zellerbach. So this is 2014. I'm just trying to make it clear. 2014, Paul Zellerbach.
He's in a tight race.
Right, to be reelected as DA.
And he's going to have pictures shown of him pulling up his opponent's signs.
Right.
And who knows whether this plays a role in the whole thing or not.
No, but a lot of people think it does, so it's worth mentioning for sure.
So, I mean, he's going to be called to testify.
Yes.
And the thought is some of this stuff is going to come out, and suddenly the charges are dropped. It just sounds really hokey stuff.
So they think that he actually arrested these guys to help himself get reelected.
Right. And then figured that it was going to backfire on him.
Okay. Because they didn't have enough evidence.
And he was going to be forced to show some damaging evidence against himself.
Oh, so his going before the grand jury, you think that stuff would have come up and further embarrassed
him? Right. I mean, my thinking from this whole timeline is that Zellerbach is thinking, this isn't good, so I'm going to drop the charges.
So that he wouldn't have to testify?
Right.
Okay. And you think that the reason he had them arrested was because he wanted to look good?
Boy, it sure seems like it took 7 years. They right. knew all this stuff virtually from day one.
Sure.
Of the crimes.
Yeah.
I mean, so why did it take so many years to come to the conclusion that we needed to arrest these two?
Yeah.
So I think I look at the timing and I'm thinking, okay, he's playing to the crowd. He wants to get reelected, which is a really shitty way of thinking. But anyway, so he indicts these two kids, two guys. And then several months later, when things are looking like they're not going to go well for him anyway, he drops the charges. I mean, it's just, I just don't understand it. I can't get my head wrapped around that.
Yeah, because that just doesn't happen.
It never happens, does it?
No.
Well, I shouldn't say never, but still.
Yeah.
I mean, they finally arrest these two, and it looks like they're going to go to trial, and boom, charges are dropped.
Yeah. Now, Robert Mason, who did a video interview, he was a former homicide detective who is the president of the Riverside County Sheriff's Association. And in this interview, he said that the evidence in the case hadn't changed at all between 2008 and 2014.
Of course it hadn't.
Right. So he believed that Paul Zellerbach, the DA, filed the case as a political move in his campaign for reelection. So there's somebody with some experience and some, he knows people in this area. He knows what's going on here. That's what he believed. Now, in May of 2014, Alex Simpson, an adjunct professor at California Western School of Law in San Diego, he said that the evidence revealed in the grand jury transcripts showed that the two suspects may have committed the crime, but there was really nothing to directly link them to the murders that would have said that an arrest was in order at that point, I guess.
So he's saying they probably never should have been arrested to begin with.
Yes, that's what he was saying, because nothing had changed between 2008, when they were kind of at the height of finding out as much as they would find out, and then those years till 2014, nothing new had been found.
Right.
Right.
And yet this other guy said there was evidence enough to indict.
What other guy?
The guy you talked about first.
That there was evidence enough to indict?
Yeah, and the one who said it was a political ploy.
Oh, yeah, but he didn't think that there was evidence enough to indict. He just thought that Zellerbach thought it would make him look good to indict the two.
Okay.
Right.
So, and this other guy said there wasn't enough evidence to indict.
Right. So that's why they dropped it, because it wasn't going to happen.
Okay.
That's what they seem to think. So in October, so they were arrested 6 months earlier, October 2014, Robert Pape and Christian Smith were released after the charges were dropped. And they were pretty happy.
They sure were.
Yeah. And at that point, the DA, Paul Zellerbach, he issued a statement calling the dismissals appropriate in light of the issues that arose during grand jury proceedings against Pape.
Yeah, so what were the issues? I mean, this is the same guy who brought charges against him. And now he's saying, basically, we shouldn't have charged him.
Well, no, he's saying that issues arose during the proceedings, which, you know, you could take that to mean that he was going to have to testify. Yeah. That could be the issue.
He's going to say the issues are, oops, something's going to happen to me.
Right. And he also added that it wouldn't be appropriate to continue the criminal proceedings against Smith because of these issues with Pape. So I guess if you don't have the motive of Pape doing it because he's the ex-boyfriend, it doesn't make any sense to try and prosecute Smith.
Well, I guess I could see that.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure why they didn't proceed with charges against Pape.
Yeah.
But we'll find out.
So the funny thing about this taking down the signs is, who was the one that witnessed the taking down of signs and filmed it?
Well, this is very interesting.
Yeah. What was his name?
This guy's name is Garcia, and his son was a putative boyfriend. Becky, a boyfriend was a guy who wanted to be her boyfriend, but he wasn't.
Well, that's what some people say. He was her friend, and some people have said that he was in love with her and wanted to be her boyfriend.
He wanted to be her boyfriend. And
so Javier Garcia
Jr. was also in the area the night of the murders.
Okay.
Briefly. And he was willing to testify, but his father, Senior Garcia Senior, it's not Senor, Garcia Senior, wanted him to be able to testify if granted immunity. And I'm not sure what the immunity was for.
So that made some people suspicious.
Well, no kidding.
So going back a little bit, Javier Jr. was friends with Becky.
Just right.
I'm just clearing it up a little because it's a little confusing.
Yeah, we're just springing this on people.
So he was friends with Becky, and he's the one that was speaking with Becky for 3 hours prior to the murder.
Right.
And he was good friends with her. Now, some people say he wanted to be more than that, but we don't know that. But we do know they were friends, and they were talking on the phone.
Right. And he was suggesting to her, according to him,
yeah,
that he would come out and go on the hike with her and the other two guys.
Which might not have been a bad idea.
As it turns
out, looking back,
probably not.
He may have been being protective of her, which makes sense.
She said they weren't going to do the hike and he didn't need to come out.
She didn't say they weren't going to do the hike. No. If she'd said that, that would change everything, don't you think? Because she was planning on going on the hike.
Well, somebody
called. She never told anyone she wasn't going on the hike.
Somebody called the hike off.
No. The guys say they called the hike off.
Right.
But we don't believe they did. If they killed her, nobody called the hike off.
Well, they
right?
said they did.
Well, sure they did, because they were accused of murder.
Yeah.
But if you're saying that Becky called the hike off, that would kind of clear up these guys from being the murderers, don't you think?
Well, no, because they were in the area, and there's enough circumstantial evidence that puts them there.
Yeah, but I guess from the way I'm looking at things, and I'll only say the way I'm looking because I can't speak for anything else, but the way I look at it is these guys, or Robert Pape anyway, spoke to Becky about going on this hike. So let's say that he was planning on hurting her, just for the sake of argument here. Let's say he was planning on hurting her.
Okay.
So he asked her on the hike and she agreed, right?
Right.
So if she had canceled the hike, that might have made her safe from these killings. According to her friends, the hike was planned, and Becky planned on going on the hike.
Okay.
So that's why I don't really want you saying that she canceled the hike. We have no evidence she canceled the hike.
Well, somebody canceled the hike.
Well, not necessarily. I think that the hike ended up being an attack and murders. Becky didn't tell Javier that she canceled the hike. She just told him that he didn't need to come and go on it with them.
Okay.
See what I'm saying?
I guess, yeah. I just, looking at that, I thought she had told him that they weren't going to do it, so he didn't need to come out.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
And you could be right, but I don't think so.
Either way.
I think she was planning on going out on the hike. So my belief is that she went to go on a hike with them, and this is when the attack and the murders happened.
Okay.
That's my way of looking at it.
It's a good way.
You think so?
Yeah.
So anyway, back to what we were talking about was that she talked to this guy for 3 hours. He had started heading towards the house, saying that he would go on the walk with them. And I don't know if that was a protective move or what, because he ended up not testifying because his father, who worked for the sheriff's department, wouldn't let him testify unless he was offered immunity.
Yeah. And we've talked about this. I mean, I'm thinking, why do you need immunity if you're innocent? And,
well,
and you're,
yeah,
you're looking at it as the father's protecting his son.
I could see it that
and,
way.
And I guess I can. We can both come to some middle ground there.
Maybe. Well, I don't know. We'll see. Maybe.
But still, it sounded suspicious to me.
It sounded suspicious to lots of people, that, I think. Yeah.
You know, I'll let my son talk to the grand jury if you give him immunity.
Well, I'm thinking that he might have felt that his son was going to be looked at as a suspect.
Well, sure.
Because he was headed up to the house.
Yep.
So if that's the case, maybe you wouldn't want him to testify unless he's offered immunity.
Well,
I can see that.
I can see that, but yeah. I mean, he wasn't her boyfriend.
No.
And he ended up not being in the area at all at the time of the murders.
Well, they did figure that out, yeah.
So
but I think
he wasn't going to be a suspect.
Right.
So I don't know why the insistence on immunity came about, but anyway.
I don't know. I think it could have just been a protective measure by his father.
Yes, it could have been.
I think if you work in law enforcement, you probably see that innocent people do get railroaded into that. And if you see that people are starting to think he wanted to be her boyfriend, he could have ended up in trouble there. And maybe you wouldn't want to talk about it at all without a lawyer then, unless they're offering immunity.
I guess so.
It could work either way, I guess.
Right.
Also, this Javier Garcia Sr., maybe he didn't have a lot of trust for the sheriff's department, the DA, because he saw this guy taking the signs down. Maybe there was a lot of corruption there.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, he's the one that videotaped or recorded the DA pulling up the signs.
So that shows you right there he didn't have a lot of trust for the system there.
No kidding.
So if you think about that, it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I'm still not sure why he was insisting on immunity for his kid.
Right, right.
I know your point, and I see your point, that I can understand that you're protecting your child.
Right.
But, yeah, anyway.
And he may have gotten him a lawyer, and the lawyer might have said that also.
Right. But he didn't testify.
He didn't testify.
That's the bottom line.
Right, right. So it was in January of 2015 that the new DA for Riverside County, Mike Hestron, took office. And right away he said he was beginning a reexamination of the case.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's hardly any murders in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that's been going on for years and years. And I'm sure the community is divided about who could have been the perpetrator. And it's time to come to some kind of closure.
Well, yeah, because they're probably thinking these murderers are still out there.
Right.
And if the case isn't solved, that's putting the whole community at risk.
There's people out there that did this. And,
right.
And they haven't been charged with the crime.
So that would make the whole community feel unsafe.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I can understand that.
So he's made it his campaign promise, and he's elected, and he's going to find who did it.
And he seems like a go-getter from the interviews I've seen with him. He went right in there and said he was reexamining it. And then it was in June 2016 that Robert Pape and Christian Smith were rearrested for the murders of John Howard, Vicki Friedley, and Becky Friedley.
So do they have new evidence, or do they have a confession or something? Or what do they have? Why did they rearrest them?
Well, this is the big question, and it's hard to find out much about this at this point. Because
it certainly
is. It's pretty new. I mean, they were only arrested the beginning of the summer. But according to court documents, the charges are based on a new informant, better cell phone tracking, and the advancement of the DNA tests.
Okay.
Right.
So who's the new informant that we have? We're having conjectures here.
Yeah, my conjectures would be that it's either Pape's ex-wife, because Robert Pape's wife, Sarah, and he are divorced now.
Yeah.
And there was some talk about when he was in jail in 2014, there were recorded phone calls of him calling her and asking her to hide firearms.
Right.
In the home.
One of which was a similar caliber, the same caliber as the murder weapon. Here's one of the murder weapons.
Right. And at that point, they couldn't say for sure it was the gun. I guess I'm going to guess here because I'm not sure. I'm thinking it's because the bullets were so damaged in the fire they couldn't. You know how they can usually tell from the little gouges right. and stuff on the bullet if it went to a certain gun?
Yes.
I'm thinking with the fire, they weren't able to tell that
no,
for sure.
No, I think all they could tell was the caliber.
Yeah, so they knew it was the same type of gun.
Right.
Yeah.
And we have evidence that he asked his ex-wife to ditch the guns.
Yes. So that doesn't look good. And now they're divorced. So that's what leads me to think that maybe she's the new informant.
She could be a new informant.
She could be. And it's referred to as a citizen informant.
Okay. So I guess that's not a...
So it means it's not a...
A jailhouse snitch or anything.
Yeah, and it's not right. someone that's working for the police. Right. Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, could be his ex-wife.
Yeah. So, on June 21st was the initial arraignment, and it was postponed because Pape had lawyer issues, according to Smith's attorney. And I think what happened at that point was that Pape's private attorney was leaving the case, and Pape was getting an appointed attorney from the state.
Yeah. And yeah. And why was he leaving the case? Was it because Pape couldn't pay him or
well,
what?
Well, we don't know. I would guess that might be it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would make sense if he's getting a court-appointed attorney and the other one's leaving, that maybe it was just getting too expensive.
Could be. Or maybe the attorney figured that he was guilty and he didn't want to have anything to do with it.
Well, if you're a defense attorney, though, I think you have to put up with that stuff.
Yeah, you live for that stuff, don't you?
I think you really have to accept it. You have to defend guilty people. That's your job.
Right. And some of your clients are guilty.
Absolutely. Yeah, so...
So I would go with couldn't afford the attorney. And he went with a court-appointed attorney.
I think that's our best guess at this point without knowing more.
Because he didn't have a lot of money, right? He was... basically a blue-collar worker.
Yeah, I think so. He was a refrigerator repairman when
yeah.
he was...
So he doesn't have thousands of dollars lying around that he can hire an attorney with.
No, most of us don't. I mean, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
So Pape's attorney had removed himself, and when he was awaiting the court-appointed attorney, Smith had this attorney, John Patrick Dolan. Seemed like a pretty... What's the word I would use? Slick? A little bit slick.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, slick.
Not in a bad way, necessarily.
He's certainly media savvy.
Yes, you seem like a savvy attorney. I like that word.
Yeah. I mean, he was on top of things, and he's advocating for his client.
That's his job. That's what he should do.
And he's talking about the case.
Right. So in his interview, he was talking about, you know, why the arraignment was postponed because of Pape's attorney issues. And that he had filed to have the case dismissed, which I think they always do, right? Any good attorney is going to do that.
Yeah, the first thing you do is say, I want the charges dismissed because my client's innocent.
Yeah, and that's his take on it, that his client is this decorated soldier and is innocent and should not be dealing with this at all.
Right.
Right. And by the way, if you watch that 48 Hours episode on the Pinyon Pines murders, this Christian Smith had a dad who was so devoted to him. My heart breaks for him, actually. He just really seems to think his son is great and would never do any harm.
Well, he might not have.
Okay. All right, maybe not. But I guess you can see which side I'm on here.
You're a little skeptical here.
Well, I've got my opinions, which is okay, right?
Yeah.
So this John Patrick Dolan, Smith's attorney, he also said that he filed a motion to reveal who they're referring to as a citizen informant. although he believes he knows who it is, but he wouldn't say.
Yeah, but he's not saying.
He wouldn't say. So
I wish he would.
So between our discussion, we're thinking it's either Sarah, Pape's ex-wife, or it's this Javier Garcia.
Right.
And then also, which was interesting, is that he actually filed a motion and changed who the judge would be. So they had this scheduling judge, and then they went to an all-purpose judge who John Patrick Dolan said there was no issue with him being competent, but he wasn't the judge they wanted to have.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't say exactly why.
That was so interesting.
It was.
And he wouldn't explain why, except to say that it wasn't an issue of personality problems or competency.
No, but he said you are allowed to do that once, I didn't really know that. Did you? That you're allowed to do that?
Nope, I had no idea.
That was interesting to learn.
It's like striking someone from the jury. I'm just going to take my one peremptory strike and get rid of the judge.
Yep. So now I guess the judge that they have is Judge Evans, who I haven't looked into that. I have no idea who he is or who she is or anything. But I guess he prefers this Judge Evans to whoever the one before that was.
For whatever reason.
Yeah. For a reason to be determined.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was talking about why the arraignments were delayed. And basically he said that there was all this evidence, like huge amounts of evidence from 2014. And now this evidence was reorganized by the prosecution. Reorganized, updated, all this stuff. They put a lot of work into it over the last couple of years. And so it's going to take this court-appointed attorney at least 2 months to process this.
Right.
That's what he said back in June. So he said that Pape's new attorney would need this time before the arraignment could be done. So the arraignment was done, and I don't have a specific date, but I believe it was in September. It wasn't too long ago that the arraignment was done. And so both of these men, Robert Pape and Christian Smith, both pleaded not guilty.
Of course.
In the case.
Yeah.
So that's where we're at now. They both pleaded not guilty, and we're waiting for the trial. I don't think they've started jury selection yet, so could be a while.
It certainly sounds like there's a lot of legal maneuvering.
Absolutely. This attorney tried to get him out on bail. That was a no-go.
This attorney, it was a 6-minute interview.
Yes.
And he covered a whole bunch of stuff.
He did. He knew what he was talking about, I would have to say.
Yeah, he would be formidable in court.
He seems like he would be a good attorney if you're in a situation like that. He would probably be someone who would try and help you.
Right.
Yeah. So that was interesting. So now we're just waiting for the trial to begin. But with all this evidence being updated and having this new informant, I'm going to say I think they're going to be found guilty, and that's totally without any kind of facts behind it. But I just think they're probably going to be found guilty. It looks like they have enough evidence this time. From what I've seen, they look pretty damn guilty. What do you think about that?
No, I agree.
You do? Okay.
I think they have enough circumstantial evidence, and they have some new stuff in terms of informant. The people in the area want to find some guilty person.
Well, sure, of course they do.
So I think they're going to go.
Well, and the family and friends of the Friedleys and the Howard families definitely think that these guys are the ones that did it.
Right. Which doesn't necessarily mean that they're actually the ones that did it.
No, it doesn't.
But I think they're going to be found guilty.
I do too. But that's why they have their day in court. Now, an interesting thing is that Pape could get the death penalty, but Smith can only get life in prison because he was only 17. He was a minor when the crimes happened, which brings me back to this whole idea of being tried as an adult. Now, he's 17, so even if you're tried as an adult and you're under 18, you can't get the death penalty?
I don't have enough legalese to be able to answer that question.
Okay.
we've talked about is it case by case or is it by age or what?
But I think it seemed to me what they were saying from what I read was that because he was a minor, he was not eligible for the death penalty, regardless of the crimes or whether he was guilty.
But he might have been maybe not an active participant.
Psh. Well, how's that? How would that happen?
I mean, he was with his friend Pape, who committed the crimes, and he was just a bystander.
So he's still, by the rules of felony murder,
well,
he's still guilty.
We're going to talk about that somewhere down the road.
Right.
Okay. So I don't know.
Yeah. It's a horrible crime, though. I mean, just one of the worst. What a beautiful young woman, and it's just horrible what they did to these people.
Well, I mean, the horror is the method of killing her. I just can't grasp.
No, if she was burned alive, that's just the worst fucking thing I've ever heard.
I hope she was unconscious of it, you know.
I can only hope she was dead before they burned her.
Or dead. I mean, they...
But they didn't find a bullet. They don't believe she was shot, she as far as I know.
I guess she wasn't shot, but still. I mean, they dumped her in a wheelbarrow and lit her on fire.
Yeah.
That's just horrific.
Yeah.
So whoever did it, I hope they find out.
Well, there was a witness in the jail who said that Christian Smith told him. He was kind of bragging and going on about how things got so out of control at the crime that they had to burn everything, quote, down to the ground, end of quote.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the house with the adults in it. The sister or the child.
Well, I mean, she may have been in the house when it happened. We don't know how it happened. We don't know the order. If they killed Becky and then they went and got the parents, we have no idea how it happened.
No, we don't.
Maybe some of that will come out in court, but we probably will never know unless one of them gets a conscience and confesses, but that doesn't look like it's going to happen.
No, nobody's ratted out on the other one yet.
No. So that doesn't look likely to happen.
Nope.
No. Anything else to say about this?
Well, I hope they get a conviction.
So that the lot is just standing there. I guess they're never going to rebuild there because everyone who lived there is gone, and Ron Friedley says he can't even look at the place at this point.
Oh, can you imagine?
The poor guy, yeah. It's just horrible. Horrible. So I guess that's all we can say about it for now until we find out more when it goes to court.
We'll come to a denouement.
Yes. Just so everybody knows, there are a few ways to support True Crime Brewery. If you go to our website, www.tygraber.com, you can click on Team Tygraber Perks, and there are three levels of support, starting at only $2 a month. For your support, you'll receive a little perk from the brewery, and as time goes on, there will be special materials just for members, special episodes and things like that, which it's a big project, so we're working on that at this point. But if you want a free and easy way to offer our support, you can go to tygraber.com/Amazon and do your Amazon shopping. And we'll get a little bit of a kickback from Amazon without you spending anything extra. Just shop and buy what you would normally buy, and you can support us just by taking that little extra step of typing in our address.
See how easy that is?
Yeah, you can also go to our website and click on some links. We have an Amazon gift card link you can click on and buy some Amazon gift cards to give us a little bit of support. There is also the Audible, Amazon Audible. You can try that out for a month. You can get a free trial of Showtime Anytime for a month. Clicking on that link on our On True Crime Movie portion of our website. And that way you can watch Showtime free for a month. So that's pretty cool. Especially now you've got the new season of The Affair coming out. And you can watch all the previous episodes of Ray Donovan, Shameless, all the great Showtime shows.
Masters of Sex.
Masters of Sex, that's right. So, not to sell out for too long, but these are great ways to help us out, support the podcast. The more you support the podcast, the more time we can put into it, and the more and the better material we can offer. So, thanks a lot for listening to this episode of True Crime Brewery. The podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or you can always just listen to it from our website, tygraber.com. If you like the podcast, please follow us on Twitter at tygraberpods. We're also on Instagram, tygraberpodcasts, where you can get updates on upcoming episodes, also on the latest beers that Dick's drinking and reviewing. Also, you might see some cute pictures of our dogs there. Dick likes to pose our dogs with his beers, and it makes for some great pictures.
Well, they're very photogenic.
Yes, they are. They're great-looking dogs.
They are.
We also have a Facebook page, which I like to update it 2 or 3 times a week. I update that so that you know what's coming up, and I might throw a dog on there once in a while if it's a really cute picture. You can give us a like on Facebook at facebook.com/tiegrabberpodcasts or tiegrabber.com/Facebook. We still love to get 5-star reviews, and you can leave us a 5-star review on iTunes at tiegrabber.com/rateusonitunes. Also, if you're not on iTunes and you want to give us a review, just send it in to us on the contact page on our website, tiegrabber.com. And another thing we're really trying to encourage is to leave voicemails on our website. Now, we've only gotten the one, and it was a good one.
And we played that one.
We did play it.
So if you want to be famous, send us a voicemail.
Sure. So if you go to our website, and on the right-handed side, it says send voicemail. So all you have to do is click on that either on your phone or on your computer, and you can say what you think. You know, hey, Jill and Dick, why don't you do this more? Or why don't you do this less? Or I like your podcast, but I sure wish you'd stop doing that. Or I sure wish that you'd do this more. And we'd love to hear your comments, and we will happily play it because we really want to get the voices of our listeners onto the podcast, not just our voices all the time, right?
Absolutely.
We want to get more input and make this more of a group affair. Something
right.
With some more, a community.
We could be more interactive.
Yes, right? We definitely want to be more interactive. And, you know, just to let you know, Dick's got some great ideas for contests using the voicemail. So you might want to practice now and send us a couple voicemails because we're going to have some cool stuff coming up around the holidays.
Right.
Right. So thanks a lot for listening again and supporting Tiegrabber and True Crime Brewery.
You guys are good listeners. We thank you very much.
Yep. So until then, we will see you at the quiet end.
Go grab a beer, guys and girls.
Bye-bye.
Bye.